It's time for ER 101 with expert guests provided by the American College of Emergency Physicians. Here's Dr. Lee Vinoker.
Hi, and welcome back to ER 101. We're talking to Dr. Dan Morheim. He's the author of a new book called The Better End, and it's all about advanced directives and being able to make the choice for how and when you want to die and the care you want to receive at the end of life. And, you know, it is a critical thing. You know, we've talked about how our society doesn't deal well with death, and maybe even doctors for a long time didn't. But there is this whole concept of death with dignity. But I wanted to ask you, Dr. Morheim, because, you know, everyone talks about healthcare dollars and the cost. And it's true that we are spending most of the healthcare dollars the last 6 months of anyone's life. But what do you say to people who say, okay, I've been healthy. Now I got cancer. Yeah, I want to try everything I want. That's when my healthcare dollars are going to be spent.
Sure, and that's, of course, entirely appropriate. But when doctors and patients work together well, people can come to an understanding that at times, more care, in quotes, may not be the best care. If you have, you know, if you get hit by a car on the way home, sure, please go to a trauma center. If you have a new diagnosis of major disease, absolutely get the best care. But if you have stage 4 metastatic pancreatic cancer or glioblastoma and everything's been done, is really another round of chemotherapy, hospitalization, radiation really going to make a difference? I think those are very difficult clinical and personal questions, and it's ones that we ought to support physicians and other clinicians and patients to have. But let's talk. Unfortunately, we don't get supported to have those conversations, and that's something that needs to be fixed. But let me talk about the money for a minute. We've certainly got a lot of fiscal crisis in the country. Everybody has read about sequesters, fiscal cliff, Affordable Care Act, funding of everything, state budgets. Let me walk through some numbers. 35% of Medicare is end-of-life care, defined as the last 6 months of life, and as the baby boom generation hits, that number is surely going to increase to 40 or 45%. Medicaid, and as a state legislator in Maryland, we deal with that all the time. Medicaid is typically, in a state, the single first, second, or third biggest line item in a state budget. It's billions of dollars. Right. Most of that money goes for chronic care. Not very much of it, typically only 25 or 30% of that money goes to most of the Medicaid enrollees who are children. But think, too, in commercial insurance, self-funded, retiree health. Detroit City, in part, is bankrupted, and a lot of businesses and government entities are facing stress because they're financial stress because they're looking at a huge liability for retiree health. Now, there are all sorts of ways to control healthcare costs, and unfortunately, we pick things that are often not friendly to patients or providers, make it harder for patients to see providers. We increase copays and other kinds of fees. Premiums go up, which burdens employers. We make it harder for providers to get paid. Those are all options, but because when most people complete advanced directives and they have the chance to think it through, most people do not check the box, although some do, and it's their choice. Do not check the box that says, give me everything, every possible treatment, everything possible. Most people don't do that. And so you start saving a lot of money by respecting individual choice and values. That's a right way to make those kinds of decisions. Imagine if the normal, let's say, instead of only 30% of people complete advanced directives, it was 90%, and it became as routine for everybody, even those over the turn 18. Remember, the three most famous cases in American legal history are women under 30, Suzanne Quinlan and Terry Schiavo.
Imagine that
became 90%. Yeah. Well, and then you look at that 35% of Medicare. Let's say that was reduced by 50% or 20%. Well, you'd be saving billions of dollars just on that. Even if it was just 10% in reduction, 10% of 35% is 3.5%, 4%. Saving 4% of Medicare is billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So there is an opportunity to save money here, but that's being done the right way by involving individuals and their practitioners in difficult but important discussions about end-of-life care, and that's empowerment and values.
Yeah. I mean, I see, you know, I can see where it is a slippery slope, and then you see these cases of people, these miraculous things that, you know, because that's what makes the news. We all know there's, you know, so much sensationalism, even in medical news today. And then you see these things, and it's hard for people to separate, you know, and it's
well,
hard for them,
you know,
to
we
understand.
Hear about those things, but I can tell you from years of practice, I've never actually seen that. And in fact, you know, the statistics are pretty straightforward. If you have a creatinine of over 2 and you have a cardiac arrest in a hospital, your chances of survival to leave the hospital are 0. I mean, that's just, there's a whole bunch of statistics on that. Mm-hmm. We don't like
so
to think
about
them.
For people that are listening, meaning your kidneys are already
aren't
not
working.
Functioning, right?
Not
and
functioning,
then
but not that badly. Not that badly. So, you know, we all, on TV, you know, the resuscitation success rate is, you know, 80 or 90%. In reality, we know it's less than 2%. But you make clinical decisions about this. If there was a 25-year-old who fell through the ice in winter and was underwater for a long time, that's a person you're going to work very hard for hours to resuscitate because you know clinically people can recover from that and recover completely. On the other hand, if it's a person way older who's had very advanced disease, dementia, cancer, and all these other things, and they have a prolonged cardiac arrest, the chances of their recovery, if you continue it, are very slim, if none. If at all. So, you know, these are judgments that have to be made. They're not easy. They're tough. But in the absence of directions from patients, care still happens. Things still happen. And then you're delivering a lot of services that may or may not be required or even helpful.
Right.
And so
or
it's not like it doesn't
wanted.
Happen, but why not have as many of these decisions as possible managed by patients and providers in collaboration?
Yeah, no, I see that. I do see that. But then, as I say, you know, what do you tell to people that we're pushing the envelopes? We're doing face transplants. We're doing, you know, that, you know, 50 years ago, somebody, you know, got electrocuted. There was a case that was in, you know, all the magazines, and the very first face transplant ever who was, you know, hit a high tension wire with his forehead. I mean, that person would have died 30 years ago. So, you know, and he has gone on and survived. And so
yeah, and, that, and that's, of course,
no, go
that,
ahead.
That, of course, is wonderful, but that's not most of what happens to most people. We never want to sacrifice the good for the perfect. Yes, there's always going to be clear-cut things one way or another and some in the middle, and everybody needs to be informed. But, you know, it's really, those are, that really doesn't have anything to do with end-of-life care. That person, you know, they can get have their face transplant, and there'll be other great developments in healthcare, which are just going to make these decisions more challenging when they come up. Because nonetheless, no matter how you look at it, 100% of us are going to die. So we approach end of life care with intelligence and foresight, or we, put our heads in the sand, pretend it's not going to happen. But it's more important now than ever that people be involved in those decisions and think about them. And I know it's hard. I understand it's hard. It's hard for me and my family. I'm a human being, too. It's hard. But the advantages that we have now with free, legal, straightforward forms, with the clinical care that's available, we're really different and more empowered than anybody. So let's do it with some intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And we only have a minute. What do you tell people?
Sure.
I mean, if there's... You can have an advanced directive, and, you know, what do you tell those people that say, well, what if something does come along? Well, as long as you're healthy, right, and you hear of something new, you could try it. But usually people at the end of cancer, they're pretty resigned sometimes, right?
Well, you can change your advanced directive anytime you want, and it's just something for people to think about. I suggest everybody take a look at it and think about it, and I think they'll be more comfortable if they do.
Yeah, certainly an important conversation, a great book to sort of help guide you through it, The Better End by Dr. Dan Morheim, an interesting topic, one you need to talk about with loved ones. Well, this has been ER 101. I'm Dr. Lee Vanocur.